We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows laundry day should be easy. Achieve maximum versatility with a dryer door that swings open either way, making load transfer from washer to dryer a breeze. Plus, with LG ThinQ, save time by controlling your washer remotely. Shop LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances, today at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.
Story 1. I used to work in a high-security forensic mental health hospital specializing in the rehabilitation of patients who had committed unspeakable crimes during psychotic episodes. It wasn't for the faint-hearted, but I'd always told myself that I could handle it. That was before I met Eva. Eva was unlike any patient I had encountered. Quiet, almost ethereal in her demeanor, she rarely spoke unless prompted, and even then, her responses carried a childlike innocence that sent shivers down your spine. She was there because during a psychotic episode, she drowned all three of her children in the bathtub. She had been the one to call the ambulance, her voice frantic, begging them to come quickly. But it was too late. The chilling part. The emergency call was recorded. The hospital kept it as part of her case file, though Eva had never been allowed to listen to it. The recording was infamous among the staff. A few who'd heard it couldn't sleep for weeks. You could hear the children's cries, their desperate pleas for her to stop, and Eva's hauntingly calm reassurances as she carried out the act. I avoided that recording like a plague. I didn't need to hear it to know the weight of what she had done. But Eva, she remembered it in her own way. During dissociative episodes, she'd recite the children's cries word for word, her voice soft and melodic, as if she were singing a lullaby. It was unsettling, to say the least. One night, I was assigned to do the rounds. It was late, just past 3 a.m. The witching hour, as some of the older nurses like to call it. The hospital halls were deathly silent, the kind of quiet that pressed against your ears and made you hyper-aware of your own breathing. I came to Eva's room and found the door ajar. That wasn't unusual. Sometimes she'd leave it open, a small act of rebellion against the locked doors that defined her life. Still, I knocked lightly before stepping inside. The room was dimly lit, the only light coming from the faint glow of the moon filtering through the barred window. Eva was sitting on the floor, her back to me, her head tilted slightly as if listening to something only she could hear. "Eva?" I called softly. No response. I took a cautious step closer. That's when I noticed the blocks. Scattered across the floor were brightly colored letter cubes. The kind you'd find in a children's playroom. At first, I thought they were just toys the staff had given her as part of her therapy, something to keep her occupied. But as I stepped closer, I saw the word they spelled out: cold. The air in the room felt different then, heavier, colder. A chill ran down my spine, the kind that makes your whole body tense instinctively. "Eva," I repeated, a little louder this time, "are you okay?" She didn't turn around, didn't acknowledge me at all. Instead, she began to hum softly, a tune so familiar it twisted my stomach. It was a lullaby, one I'd heard her hum before, but this time it felt wrong. The notes lingered too long in the air, each one like a drop of icy water sliding down my neck. I bent down to pick up one of the blocks, almost without thinking. As soon as my fingers touched it, a sharp, piercing cold shot through my hand. I dropped the block immediately, gasping. That's when Eva spoke. "Do you hear them?" Her voice was soft, barely above a whisper, but it carried a weight that made my chest tighten. "Hear who, Eva?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. "Them," she said, her head tilting further, as if straining to hear something distant. "They're so cold." The room felt like it dropped 10 degrees. My breath came out in a visible puff, and the hair on the back of my neck stood on end. I glanced at the blocks again. Now they spelled out something different. Stop. My heart was racing, pounding so hard I thought it might burst out of my chest. I backed up a step, suddenly desperate to leave the room, but something kept me rooted in place. Eva began to recite, her voice taking on that same innocent tone that made my skin crawl. "Mommy, please don't do this," she said, mimicking a child's voice. Her words hit me like a physical blow. "Eva, stop," I said, my voice trembling. "You don't have to do this." She ignored me, continuing in the same hauntingly sweet tone. "It's so cold, Mommy. I don't want to go in the water. Please, Mommy, stop." I wanted to scream at her to shut up, to snap her out of whatever trance she was in, but I couldn't move, couldn't speak. My feet felt glued to the floor as if some unseen force was holding me there. Eva finally turned to look at me, and I'll never forget what I saw. Her eyes were wide, unblinking, and filled with tears that spilled down her pale cheeks. But it wasn't just the sadness in her eyes that froze me in place. It was the reflection. Behind me, in the shadowed corner of the room, I saw them. Three small figures, their outlines faint but unmistakable. Children. They stood silently, their heads tilted, their gazes fixed on me. And then, as if in unison, they stepped forward. I spun around, but the corner was empty. Nothing there but the suffocating darkness. When I turned back to Eva, she was smiling, a serene, almost motherly smile. "They don't like it when you come in here," she said softly. "They only want me." That was it. That was my breaking point. I bolted from the room, slamming the door shut behind me. I didn't stop running until I was outside, gulping in the cold night air like a drowning man. I quit the next day, told my supervisor I couldn't do it anymore. Didn't give any details, just packed up my things and left. Story 2. I never thought much about working nights in an old psychiatric ward until I actually found myself alone in its dim, echoing halls. They say these places have memories of their own. Echoes of the pain, the laughter, and the silence that's far too deep. I shrugged it off at first, but there's something about the quiet at 2 a.m. that makes the walls feel alive. That summer night started like any other. I had four patients on my adolescent unit, all in for different reasons, none of them particularly alarming. It was a light caseload. The summer months are usually quieter. Fewer kids struggling, fewer crises. But the calm nights are the ones that always catch you off guard. The ward itself is ancient, with creaky wooden floors and heavy doors that only open and close with an eerie groan. The overhead lights flickered every now and then, and no matter how many work orders we submitted, they never fixed it. That night, I was halfway through my rounds when it happened. I was in the hallway, clipboard in hand, marking off the last of my checks. The patients were asleep, their breaths rhythmic and soft behind the partially open doors. It was comforting in a way, knowing they were at peace for the night. Then out of nowhere, slam! Two doors banged shut, the sound echoing like a gunshot down the empty corridor. I froze, heart racing. The doors were directly across from each other. Room 204, which was occupied, and room 205, which had been empty for weeks. For a second, I just stood there, ears ringing from the noise. Then my training kicked in. I rushed to room 204 first, fumbling with my keys. The door was heavy, stuck slightly as I pushed it open. Inside, the patient, a wiry 15-year-old boy named Sam, was sound asleep, curled on his side, breathing slow and even. I stared at him for a moment, half expecting him to jump up and laugh at me. But he didn't move. My eyes darted around the room. Everything was in its place. His shoes by the bed, the blanket barely covering his shoulders. Nothing looked disturbed. I swallowed hard and backed out, leaving the door cracked open like protocol demanded. Then I turned to room 205. My hand hesitated on the handle. It wasn't just the emptiness of the room that unnerved me. It was the way the door seemed to hum slightly against my touch, as if it were alive. But when I opened it, the room was just as it should have been. Bare walls, neatly made bed, the faint smell of cleaning supplies lingering in the air. Nothing. Still, I felt uneasy. I pulled myself together, propped Sam's door open with one of his sneakers, and went back to the nurse's station. It was nothing, I told myself. A draft, maybe, or the building settling. But my hands were shaking as I picked up my pen to chart. The air felt wrong. Barely 10 minutes later, I heard it again, a low, muffled thud, like someone shoving a door. I whipped around to see Sam's door shut tight once more. My stomach sank. The sneaker I'd wedged there earlier was now lying in the middle of the hallway, as if it had been pushed out with deliberate force. This time, my legs didn't want to move. It felt like something heavy had settled on my chest, pressing me into my chair. I couldn't explain it. It wasn't fear exactly, but a bone-deep sense of being watched. Finally, I stood and walked back down the hall, my footsteps louder than I'd have liked. When I reached Sam's door, I pressed my ear to the wood. Nothing. Slowly, I turned the knob, pushed it open, and peered inside. Sam was still asleep. The blanket hadn't shifted, his breathing was steady, and the room was perfectly still. But the air was ice cold. Not just cool from the AC.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
See, cold enough that my breath fogged as I exhaled. I stood there for a moment, paralyzed by the unnatural chill. Then I heard it, a whisper. It was faint, barely more than a breath, but it was unmistakable. A single word, leave. It came from nowhere and everywhere at once, curling around me like smoke. My blood ran cold. I didn't wait.
I backed out of the room, keeping my eyes on Sam until I was fully in the hallway again. The second I stepped out, the warmth returned, like whatever had been in there didn't want to follow. I slammed the door open the entire way, clicking it into the wall's magnetic stopper, and stood there for what felt like an eternity, daring it to move again. The whisper echoed in my head, making my pulse race. I didn't know what I was expecting, maybe the door to slam again, or that voice to return. But nothing happened. Nothing except the faint creak of the door against the stopper, as if testing its resolve. The rest of the night passed in a haze. I stayed glued to the nurse's station, watching the hallway from the corner of my eye. The doors stayed put, the air stayed warm, and no more whispers came. But I didn't relax, not for a second. The next morning, I handed off my shift report, careful not to mention anything. What could I even say? That a door had a mind of its own? That a whisper had told me to leave? They'd laugh it off or chalk it up to sleep deprivation. But I know what I heard, and I know I wasn't alone that night. Story 3. I'll never forget that day, no matter how much I try to push it out of my mind. I'm a teacher's aide at a small community school in a rural area, the kind of place where everyone knows everyone, and kids grow up like siblings. It's quiet most days, and our biggest problem is keeping the kids focused instead of daydreaming out the windows. That morning started like any other. I was in the staff lounge, sipping lukewarm coffee and grading some papers when a frantic call came over the PA. Ms. Tate, can you come to Mrs. Johnson's room? There's an issue with one of your students. I recognized the voice. It was Mrs. Johnson, one of the most unshakable teachers in the school. For her to sound nervous, I knew it was serious. I hurried to her room and found her standing near the door, looking pale and uneasy. She motioned for me to come in. It's Evan, she whispered. He won't stop talking about Pokemon, but it's more than that. He says he's seeing things. I think you need to handle this. Evan was sitting at his desk, swinging his legs, a wide grin on his face. The other kids were staring, some giggling nervously, others visibly uncomfortable. Evan, I said, walking toward him. Let's talk. He looked up at me, his blue eyes sparkling with excitement. I see them! The Pokemon! They're everywhere! He pointed to the corner of the room. Right there, Ms. Tate. It's a Charizard. Evan, I said gently, crouching to his level. You need to focus on your work now, okay? Let's put the Pokemon away for a bit. He tilted his head, studying me. But they don't go away. They're real. The mailbox was running around my house last night. It had legs and everything. That's when I knew something wasn't right. This wasn't just a kid with an overactive imagination. His words were too vivid, his conviction too intense. All right, I said, keeping my voice calm. Let's go to the group room and call your mom, okay? He nodded and followed me out of the classroom. On the way, he chattered about how he'd been talking to a friend, someone only he could see. When we got to the group room, I picked up the phone and dialed his mother. While I explained the situation, Evan sat at the table, swinging his legs again, humming a tune I didn't recognize. Then he said something that made my stomach drop. My friend says he likes you. I paused mid-sentence, glancing at him. What friend? Evan smiled, pointing behind me. The one who talks to me. He's standing right behind you. The room suddenly felt colder. I turned slowly, half expecting to see something. Of course, the room was empty. Evan, I said, forcing a smile. What if I told you I don't believe your friend is real? He shrugged, his grin never faltering. He says you don't have to believe. He'll show you. At that exact moment, the projector in the room flickered on. It was an old machine, the kind that required a physical button to be pressed to power it on. I hadn't touched it. No one had. The screen glowed white, then black, then static. I froze, the phone slipping from my hand. Evan leaned back in his chair, looking far too calm. Do you believe me now? I couldn't move. My heart was pounding in my chest, my throat dry as sandpaper. The static on the screen began to shift, forming shapes, blurry at first, then clearer. Faces, distorted, grinning faces, their eyes dark and hollow. I don't remember turning off the projector. I don't even remember how I got out of that room. Evan's mother arrived about 15 minutes later. I handed him off without saying much, just that he wasn't feeling well and needed to go home. We never spoke about his friend again. Story 4. I was 15 when it happened, and I swear on everything I hold sacred, this was real. Not a dream, not a hallucination, not some teenage imagination running wild. I'd spent enough time in that psych ward to know what was real and what wasn't. My parents didn't know how to handle me back then. Teenage angst, they called it, but I knew better. I wasn't crazy, just angry, lost, and too loud about it. When they couldn't deal, they shipped me off to the hospital for one of my little vacations. Usually I was sent to the adolescent ward, but this time, renovations had us stuck on the adult floor. From the moment I got there, the place felt wrong. The air felt heavy, and the halls smelled like bleach and something faintly sour, like sweat soaked into the walls. The staff kept the teens and adults separated, but it didn't matter. You could feel the weight of the place pressing down on you. They gave me my own room, which should have been a blessing. No snoring roommates or late-night whispers. But that room, room 217, felt like it was alive, watching me. From the first night, I couldn't shake the feeling of being watched. I told myself it was paranoia, that I'd been in places like this before, and nothing had ever happened. But that night, the walls had these tiny LED lights in little square windows. They weren't bright enough to keep you awake, but bright enough to let the nurses peek in without turning on the main lights. It was comforting in a way, proof that I wasn't totally alone. Around midnight, I started feeling uneasy. It wasn't anything specific, just this growing dread I couldn't shake. I tried to ignore it, told myself it was the usual hospital anxiety. But when I closed my eyes, the feeling got worse, like something was in the room with me. I called for the nurse, asked if I could sit at the station for a while, maybe do a puzzle or something to take my mind off it. The guy looked annoyed, told me, "You're safe here. Go back to bed," and shut the door. I remember lying there, staring at the ceiling, trying to convince myself I was safe. And then the light in my room went out. Not flickered, not dimmed. It just died. 1 second it was on, the next I was in total darkness. My heart started pounding. I thought maybe it was a power issue or some kind of fluke, but the hall light outside my room was still glowing under the crack of my door. I froze, too scared to move. That's when I heard it, the humming. At first it was soft, almost like it was coming from the vents. I told myself it was just a nurse humming to herself while making rounds. But then it got louder. It wasn't a tune I recognized, but it sounded like a lullaby. A woman's voice, soft and lilting, singing just outside my door. I wanted to call for the nurse again, but I couldn't make myself move. The humming grew louder, closer, like whoever it was had stepped into my room. Then it stopped. I held my breath, straining to hear any sound. The room was dead silent for a moment, and I thought maybe I'd imagined it. But then I felt it. This presence standing over my bed. I opened my eyes and my breath hitched in my throat. There was someone standing at the foot of my bed. I couldn't make out any features. It was just a tall black shadow, like a human shape carved out of darkness. It didn't move, didn't make a sound. It just stood there, staring down at me. I screamed, not a startled gasp, a full-blown, blood-curdling scream. I scrambled back against the headboard, shaking, my eyes locked on that thing. It didn't flinch, didn't retreat, just stood there like it was waiting for something. The door burst open and the nurse came rushing in, his flashlight cutting through the darkness. The light hit the foot of my bed and the shadow was gone. "What's going on?" he demanded, his voice sharp. I couldn't speak. I just pointed at the foot of the bed, my hand trembling so bad I thought it might fall off. He flicked on the main light and I winced, momentarily blinded. When my eyes adjusted, six nurses were standing in my room, their faces a mix of concern and frustration. "What happened?" one of them asked. I stammered, trying to explain, but the words wouldn't come out right. There was someone there, a shadow. I swear it was there. They exchanged looks, the kind of looks that said, "She's losing it." One of them muttered something about putting me in the quiet room for the night, and the next thing I knew, I was being led down the hall. The little padded room wasn't much, just four white walls and a bright overhead light. But I felt safer there than I had in that dark, silent room. At least here, I could see everything. I didn't sleep that night. I just sat there, curled up on the thin mattress, staring at the camera in the corner. The nurses checked on me every hour, but I didn't care. I was too scared to even blink. Story 5. I've been a mental health nurse for over 15 years, mostly working in long-term care. Death isn't a stranger in my line of work. It visits quietly, often without drama, and we've learned to respect its inevitability. But one shift years ago left a mark on me that I've never been able to shake. The facility where I worked was a sprawling, aging building tucked into the edge of a small wooded town in New England. It had been a hospital during World War II, later converted into a long-term care home. The halls had this peculiar smell, a mix of antiseptic and something older, like damp wood. Some of the staff joked it was the smell of ghosts. I never bought into it, at least not until that night. It was the graveyard shift. The air felt heavier than usual, a sticky humidity that clung to your skin even indoors. I was making my rounds when I heard the faint ding of a call bell. Room 217, Mr. Draper. He was a new patient, admitted about 2 weeks earlier. He was one of those patients who seemed to shrink into himself as his illness progressed, but what made him stand out was his demeanor. Quiet but tense, always looking over his shoulder as if expecting someone to walk in uninvited. As I approached his room, I could hear the muffled sound of his voice. He was talking, no, arguing with someone. I knocked softly. Mr. Draper, it's Nurse Karen. Everything okay? The talking stopped abruptly. For a moment, the room was deathly silent. Then came a voice, low and raspy. She's here again. I stepped in, my eyes adjusting to the dim light of the single bedside lamp. Mr. Draper was sitting up, his thin body casting jagged shadows against the wall. His eyes darted to the corner of the room, near the ceiling. I followed his gaze but saw nothing but an unremarkable patch of peeling paint. Who's here, Mr. Draper? I asked, keeping my tone calm. He didn't answer immediately. His bony hand pointed to the corner, trembling slightly. Her, the woman in white, she won't leave me alone. I felt a chill run down my spine. It wasn't the first time I'd had a patient claim to see something or someone others couldn't. It happened sometimes, visions, hallucinations, but the fear in his eyes was raw, tangible. She's just watching me, he whispered. But her eyes, they're wrong. I moved closer to his bed, placing a reassuring hand on his arm. It's okay. You're safe. Sometimes our minds play tricks on us, especially when we're tired or unwell. His head snapped toward me, eyes wide. You think I'm imagining this? You think I'm crazy? His voice was rising, cracking with panic. Not at all, I said quickly. But I need you to trust me. Let's take a few deep breaths, okay? I can stay with you for a while. He didn't respond, his gaze fixed back on the corner. Then in a voice so low I almost didn't catch it, he murmured, "She's smiling now." My heart skipped a beat. I turned to look again, my stomach tightening, even though I knew I wouldn't see anything. And I didn't. Just the same empty corner. But the atmosphere in the room felt different, heavier, like the air had been sucked out and replaced with something wrong. I sat with him for about 20 minutes, eventually managing to calm him down. We gave him a mild sedative, and he drifted into a restless sleep. The rest of the night was uneventful, though I couldn't shake the unease from room 217. I tried to rationalize it. Patients hallucinate. Fear is contagious. It was all in my head, or so I thought. 3 nights later, I was on the same shift. Around 3 a.m., I was at the nurse's station, catching up on charts. The halls were eerily quiet, save for the occasional hum of the building's ancient heating system. Then I heard it, the ding of a call bell. Room 217. I sighed, grabbing my flashlight. As I approached the room, I noticed the door was slightly ajar. Soft murmurs floated out. He was talking again. Mr. Draper? I called, stepping inside. The moment I entered, the air felt colder, the kind of chill that sinks into your bones. Mr. Draper was sitting up again, but this time He wasn't looking at the corner. His gaze was locked on the foot of his bed. "She's closer now," he whispered, his voice almost childlike. I followed his line of sight, my heart pounding. And then, God help me, I saw it, just for a second, a figure, a woman, pale, almost translucent, standing at the foot of his bed. Her face was obscured by stringy white hair, but her posture was all wrong, bent forward in a way that made my stomach churn. She was there, and then, she wasn't. Gone, like a candle snuffed out. I blinked, my mind scrambling to make sense of it. It had to be a trick of the light. Exhaustion. Anything but what it looked like. But Mr. Draper's reaction told me otherwise. "She's here for me," he said, his voice trembling. "I can feel it." I tried to speak, but my mouth was dry. "There's nothing there," I managed, though the words felt hollow. He looked at me then, a sad, resigned look that sent shivers down my spine. "You saw her, didn't you?" I didn't answer. He passed away 2 nights later. Peacefully, they said. But I couldn't bring myself to go into that room again, not even to help clean it out. The night he died, the new nurse on duty swore she heard faint laughter coming from the hall outside 217. She laughed it off when she told me, but the unease in her eyes was unmistakable. Story 6. I work as a CAT scan tech in a mental hospital. I'm not going to name the place, but if you know anything about old hospitals, you can probably picture it. Long, sterile hallways, flickering lights, and an eerie stillness that sets in during the overnight shift. That's when I worked, alone, in the quiet hours between midnight and dawn. It wasn't unusual for me to sneak a nap during my break. The job wasn't physically demanding, but the monotony of the night shift could wear you down. I usually found an empty exam room, locked the door, and grabbed 15 or 20 minutes of sleep. That night started like any other. I remember feeling unusually drained. Maybe it was the weather, cold and rainy, or maybe I just hadn't slept well that day. Either way, by the time my break rolled around, I was desperate to lie down. I found an unused room, double-checked that the door was locked, and stretched out on the exam table. It wasn't the most comfortable spot, but it was better than nothing. The hum of the building's HVAC system was the only sound, lulling me into a light sleep. I don't know how long I'd been out when it happened. A hard tap on my shoulder jolted me awake. "Wake up," a voice said, clear and sharp. My eyes shot open, heart pounding. Standing by the door was a small, elderly woman. She was hunched slightly, her frame almost frail, and her dark eyes locked onto mine. She looked Asian, with a face lined by deep wrinkles and an expression I couldn't quite read, somewhere between concern and disapproval. I sat up, blinking, trying to make sense of what I was seeing. My first thought was that someone had walked in by mistake. But how? I knew I had locked the door. "Ma'am, are you lost?" I asked, my voice shaky. She didn't answer. Instead, she just stood there staring at me. The room felt colder, and the air seemed heavier, like it was pressing down on me. "Do you need help?" I tried again, louder this time. Still no response. She didn't move, didn't blink. My unease grew into full-blown fear. Something about her wasn't right. And then, as I stared back at her, she began to fade. I don't mean she turned and walked away or that the light played tricks on my eyes. She disappeared. Slowly her outline blurred and she dissolved into thin air, like smoke dissipating in the wind. I froze, every hair on my body standing on end. My brain scrambled to rationalize what I had just seen. A hallucination? Maybe I'd been more tired than I realized, or a trick of the light. But none of those explanations made sense. I sat there, stunned, for what felt like an eternity before exhaustion won out. I didn't want to, but I lay back down. My body was screaming for rest, and despite my fear, I somehow fell asleep again. When my break was over, I returned to the scanning room, still shaken. I debated whether I should tell anyone. The last thing I wanted was to sound crazy, especially in a place like this. But my coworker, Mike, noticed immediately. "You look like you've seen a ghost," he said with a chuckle. I forced a laugh. "I think I did." Mike raised an eyebrow. "What do you mean?" I hesitated, then spilled everything. I described the woman, her appearance, the way she tapped me awake, how she vanished before my eyes. I expected him to laugh or call me nuts. Instead, his expression turned serious. "Wait, was she small? Asian? Old?" he asked slowly. A chill ran down my spine. "Yeah, you've seen her." He nodded, his face pale. "I've seen her. Twice, actually. Once in the stairwell and another time near the lab. She doesn't say much, just stares at you. The first time, I thought it was a patient who'd wandered off, but then she disappeared. Like, gone." We both fell silent, the weight of what we'd experienced settling between us. Mike told me he'd heard stories from other staff members about strange sightings in the hospital. People reported seeing figures, hearing voices, or feeling like they were being watched. "Do you think it's..." I started, but he cut me off. "I don't know what it is," he said, shaking his head. "But this place has a history. You know it used to be a sanatorium, right? And some of the stuff they did back then, let's just say it wasn't humane." I didn't ask for details. I didn't want to know. From that night on, I stopped napping during my breaks. I kept the lights on, stayed busy, and avoided being alone whenever I could. But no matter how much I tried to push it out of my mind, I couldn't forget her. The way she looked at me wasn't angry or hostile. It was sad, almost like she was trying to tell me something. I never saw her again. Story 7. My name's Angela, and I grew up in a small town tucked deep in the Scottish Highlands. The kind of place where everyone knows everyone else's business and the winters are long, dark, and lonely. My mom worked as a psychiatric nurse at a crumbling, Victorian-era hospital on the outskirts of town. A place most people whispered about with unease. Tales of ghostly patients and eerie occurrences floated around, though Mum always brushed them off as nonsense. One night, I overheard her telling my dad something that shook me to the core. She never liked to talk about work, but that night was different. It was the only time she ever shared something so strange, so chilling, that I still get shivers thinking about it. "It was a winter evening," she said, "and snow had been falling steadily for hours. Mum was working the night shift, a quieter but eerier time in the hospital. Most of the patients were already sedated, the endless wails and muttering of the day reduced to occasional creaks and moans of the old building settling into the night. She had been looking for her colleague, Liz, another nurse. They had been working together earlier in the evening, and Mum needed to hand over some patient notes before the end of her shift. Liz had a habit of disappearing, slipping away for a quick smoke in the stairwell or a cup of tea in the staff room. Mum said she checked all the usual spots, the nurse's station, the break room, even the little kitchen where Liz liked to sneak biscuits. Nothing. The hospital felt unusually quiet that night, she said, like the whole building was holding its breath. Eventually, she decided to check the east wing, the oldest part of the hospital and the least used. It had been partially closed off years ago, but some patients still occupied the few usable rooms on the first floor. Mum hated that wing. She said it always felt wrong, like someone or something was watching. As she walked down the long, narrow corridor, her footsteps echoed off the cracked tiles. The overhead lights flickered faintly, casting strange shadows on the peeling walls. She came to a heavy wooden door with a reinforced glass panel set into it. It was a halfway point between the main building and the east wing, and the glass was old, warped, and speckled with scratches. Mum leaned forward to peer through the glass, squinting to see if Liz might be on the other side. That's when she saw it, a reflection in the glass. Someone standing just behind her, clear as day. A figure in the faintly distorted pane. "Oh, there you are," she said automatically, relieved to have finally found her colleague. She turned around, but there was no one there. The corridor behind her was completely empty. She froze, the words catching in her throat. Slowly, she turned back to the glass, her pulse hammering in her ears. The reflection was gone. At that moment, she told us, she felt a chill unlike anything she'd ever experienced. It wasn't the kind of cold that comes from a drafty hallway or a bad winter. It was something deeper, something that seemed to seep into her bones and freeze her from the inside out. Mum stood there, rooted to the spot, for what felt like an eternity. Every instinct screamed at her to move, to run, but she couldn't. All she could do was stare at the empty corridor and the warped, scratched glass. Finally, she forced herself to step forward and push open the door. The East Wing was as silent and deserted as the rest of the hospital. No Liz, no patients awake, nothing. Mum walked through the wing quickly, her heart racing. She checked every room, every corner, calling out Liz's name in a voice that wavered with barely concealed panic, but she found nothing. Eventually, she returned to the main part of the hospital, shaken but trying to brush it off as a trick of the light or her imagination, playing games with her tired mind. It wasn't until hours later, when her shift was nearly over, that Liz finally appeared. "Where the hell were you?" Mum asked, half angry, half relieved. Liz frowned, confused. "I've been in the break room this whole time. You never came in." Mum didn't argue. She didn't want to explain what she'd seen or what she thought she'd seen. But as she left the hospital that morning, the first rays of sunlight creeping over the frosted hills, she glanced back at the East Wing, and for just a split second, she thought she saw a shadow move across one of the windows. She never spoke about that night again, at least not to me, but the look in her eyes as she told the story said it all. It wasn't just the reflection that had unsettled her. It was something else, something she couldn't quite put into words. Mum stayed at that hospital for another 5 years before transferring to a smaller clinic closer to town, but she avoided the East Wing after that, and she always left work before sunset when she could help it. Story 8. I've worked in psychiatric care for over 20 years. You'd think I'd seen it all. Psychotic breaks, violent outbursts, tragic lows. But there's one night that still chills me. One sound that I can never forget. The facility was an older building, a sprawling maze of sterile corridors lined with aluminum handrails. At night, the lights buzzed faintly, and shadows stretched long down the halls. That night, the place seemed darker than usual. Maybe it was my imagination. Maybe it was just a bad vibe in the air. The patient's name was Julia, mid-30s, thin, pale, with hair that hung in uneven clumps around her face. She had been with us for 3 weeks, admitted after a severe psychotic episode. Schizophrenia, they said. But something about her didn't fit the textbook. Her episodes weren't just delusions or voices. They were different. When Julia screamed, it wasn't like other patients. It wasn't random or frantic. It was deliberate, almost measured. She would sit cross-legged on her bed, her hands gripping the thin blanket, and wail, a single high-pitched note that seemed to pierce straight through your skull. That night, she was particularly relentless. It started around 9 p.m., right after the evening meds. At first, it was the usual shriek. I was at the nurse's station with Donna, one of the newer techs, and we exchanged weary glances. "Julia again," Donna muttered, rolling her eyes. I sighed. "I'll check on her. Maybe she missed her meds." I walked down the corridor to her room. The sound grew louder with each step, a sharp, unyielding pitch that seemed to vibrate in my chest. I knocked on the door. "Julia, it's Alex. Can I come in?" The screaming didn't stop. I opened the door and stepped inside. She was on the bed, knees pulled to her chest, her mouth wide open. But here's the thing. Her lips weren't moving. The sound was coming from her, but she wasn't screaming. "Julia," I said carefully, "are you okay?" Her head snapped toward me, and her eyes locked on mine. They were wide, unblinking, filled with something I can only describe as knowing. "Do you hear it?" she whispered. The scream stopped abruptly. For a moment, there was silence. Then the humming began. It started low, almost imperceptible, like a distant engine. But it grew louder, deeper, until the walls seemed to vibrate with it. I turned toward the door, thinking it might be a malfunction with the HVAC system, but the sound wasn't mechanical. It was alive. The aluminum railing on the walls began to hum, faintly at first, then louder. I placed my hand on it instinctively and jerked back. It was ice cold, almost freezing. The vibration seemed to resonate through the entire unit. "Make it stop," Julia said, her voice trembling. I took a step closer. "Julia, what's happening? What's..." She screamed again. This time her mouth did move, and the sound was deafening. It matched the frequency of the humming, perfectly synchronized. in the railing shuddered violently. The light above her bed flickered, and for a split second, I thought I saw something. A shadow darker than the room itself, sliding along the ceiling. "Julia!" I shouted, trying to snap her out of it. Her eyes rolled back, and she collapsed onto the bed, silent. The humming stopped instantly, as if someone had flipped a switch. The light stabilized. I rushed to her side and checked her pulse. It was faint but steady. Her breathing was shallow. I called for Donna and the other staff, my voice shaking. By the time they arrived, Julia was awake, but eerily calm. She looked up at us, her face pale and damp with sweat. "They don't like it when you listen," she said quietly. "Who?" I asked, my heart pounding. She didn't answer. We moved her to the medical observation room that night, where she remained under watch. She never screamed again, not once, but she wouldn't speak either. For weeks, she sat in silence, staring at the walls as if she could see something the rest of us couldn't. Maintenance inspected the railings the next day, looking for some explanation for the humming. They found nothing. No loose bolts, no mechanical issues. Julia was transferred to a long-term facility a month later. I never saw her again. Story 9. My name is Alex, and I've been an EMT for over 6 years. I don't scare easily. After all, I've seen people in every kind of situation imaginable. Blood, broken bones, chaos, you name it. But there's one night I can't get out of my head. One night that keeps me questioning everything I think I know about this world. It was just another graveyard shift. 3 a.m., the dead hour, as they call it. My partner and I had just dropped off a violent psych patient at the hospital. The guy had completely destroyed our gurney during transport, tearing the straps clean off. So I went down to the basement to grab a replacement while my partner stayed upstairs to handle the paperwork. The basement of the hospital wasn't exactly inviting. It was a maze of dimly lit corridors, filled with shelves and carts packed with unused equipment. The fluorescent lights buzzed faintly, and the air was cold enough to make my breath fog. I kept telling myself it was just another task. Get the gurney and get out. The storage unit was in the farthest corner of the basement, past rows of metal shelves stacked with old monitors, oxygen tanks, and discarded hospital furniture. The space was so cramped, you had to turn sideways just to squeeze through. I maneuvered my way in, trying not to knock anything over, when I felt it, a tug on the back of my shirt. At first, I thought it was my shirt catching on one of the shelves. I turned around, expecting to see a jagged piece of metal sticking out, but there was nothing, just the cold, empty aisle. I brushed it off as my imagination and reached for the gurney. That's when it happened again. Another tug, this time harder. "Okay, what the hell?" I muttered, spinning around. The aisle was empty, completely still. But then I heard it, a voice, a little girl's voice. "I'm lost," she said, crystal clear, like she was standing right behind me. My heart stopped. I froze, clutching the gurney like it was a lifeline. The voice wasn't muffled, wasn't faint. It was as if she was breathing the words into my ear. "Who's there?" I called out, my voice trembling. Silence. I stood there, every hair on my body standing on end, my breath quick and shallow. I wanted to move, to run, but my feet felt rooted to the floor. I scanned the aisle again, expecting to see someone, a child maybe, though I knew that made no sense. The PICU, the pediatric intensive care unit, was locked down for the night. "No visitors were allowed in the hospital at this hour," the voice came again, softer this time. "I'm lost." The air around me felt heavier, colder. It was as if the basement itself was holding its breath, waiting for me to respond. "Listen," I said, forcing my voice to stay steady. "If someone's down here, you shouldn't be. This area is restricted." I strained to hear a reply, but all I got was the faint hum of the overhead lights. My pulse was hammering in my ears, and I could feel sweat trickling down my back despite the chill. Then out of the corner of my eye, I saw movement. Something small darted across the end of the aisle. "Hey!" I yelled, stepping forward instinctively. I rounded the corner, but the aisle was empty. Just more shelves, more equipment, and that suffocating stillness. I could feel my chest tightening as I backed away, dragging the gurney with me. I wasn't about to stay down there alone. I pulled out my radio and called my partner. "Hey, can you come down here? I need a hand with this gurney. My voice sounded shaky, even to me. On my way, he replied, sounding confused. While I waited, I kept my back against the nearest wall, my eyes darting between the aisles. Every shadow seemed to shift. Every noise felt amplified. I kept telling myself it was nothing, just fatigue messing with my head. But then I heard it again, faint but unmistakable. I'm lost. The voice was coming from deeper in the storage unit now, farther down the maze of aisles. My partner's footsteps echoed down the stairwell, and I nearly jumped out of my skin when he appeared around the corner. What's going on? He asked, looking at me like I'd lost my mind. I hesitated. How do you explain something like that? I thought I heard someone, I said finally. A little girl. His brow furrowed. Down here? At this hour? I nodded, feeling ridiculous even as I said it. We searched the entire basement together, checking every aisle, every corner. But there was nothing. No sign of anyone. No voice. My partner tried to laugh it off. Probably just the pipes, he said. These old buildings make all kinds of weird noises. I didn't argue. What was the point? We hauled the gurney upstairs and finished our shift, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. A few days later, I mentioned the incident to one of the hospital security guards. He gave me a strange look and said, "You're not the first person to hear that." "What do you mean?" I asked, my stomach dropping. He leaned in closer, lowering his voice. "They say a little girl died here years ago. Got lost in the basement and, well, they found her too late. People hear her sometimes asking for help." I felt the blood drain from my face. I never went back to that basement alone again. Story 10. I used to work on a neurostep down unit. It was one of those places where the lights never quite felt right, where everything seemed to be on the edge of normal, but just a little off. If you've ever worked in a hospital, especially one that deals with critical care, you know that the night shift is different. The silence is thicker, the hallways longer, and your mind starts to wander into places it shouldn't. But there were some nights when even my tired mind couldn't make sense of what I saw. This particular night stands out. I was the CNA on the floor, just finished helping with a round of vitals and setting up a few rooms for the night. We were short-staffed as usual, but nothing out of the ordinary. The unit was quiet. The kind of quiet where you could hear the faint beep of machines from down the hall and the occasional shuffle of shoes on the linoleum floor. There was one patient on our floor that night I couldn't help but think about. A man in his 60s, completely unresponsive. He had suffered a massive stroke, leaving him nonverbal, bedridden, and requiring a feeding tube for nutrition. He was restrained to prevent him from pulling at the tubes or causing harm to himself. His condition was so critical that he rarely even had family visit. I had taken care of him several times before, but tonight felt different. I was sitting at the CN desk, just filling out some charts, when the call light went off. The unit was mostly empty, so the sound of the light was startling in the dead of the night. I glanced at the screen. Room 8. It was his room. "Hello," I answered over the intercom. To my surprise, it wasn't a nurse or a family member on the other end. It was a woman's voice, clear but oddly distant. "He's really hurting," she said, her tone soft, almost pleading. "He needs his pain medication." I froze for a moment. The voice sounded familiar, but I couldn't place it. I glanced down the hallway at room 8. The lights in there were dimmed, but I could see the outline of his body in the bed, motionless, just like he always was. I got up slowly, my steps echoing in the silent hallway as I made my way to the room. When I entered, the room was pitch dark, the only light coming from the faint glow of the monitoring machines. I could hear the rhythmic sound of his breathing, deep, steady, and completely calm. I stood at the foot of his bed, watching him for a moment. He looked like he was sleeping peacefully, almost like nothing had ever happened to him. But the call light had just gone off again. The same room, the same voice. I grabbed the light and answered it again. "Please," the voice said, just as desperate as before. "He's really hurting."
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
I felt a chill wash over me. I tried to calm myself, telling myself that it was probably just a glitch, a faulty intercom, or maybe some well-meaning family member who didn't realize he wasn't conscious. But there was something in that voice that unsettled me. I turned around and quickly walked back to the desk, trying to shake off the unease. I couldn't quite explain it, but it didn't feel right. The call light going off twice like that, the same exact words. I told the nurse on shift about the situation, but she just shrugged and said, "Maybe someone is trying to check in on him. Let's give him some pain meds just in case." I nodded, but I wasn't convinced. I went back to his room with the nurse, the same eerie silence hanging in the air. The nurse checked his vitals and repositioned him in bed, making sure he was comfortable. We gave him the pain medication through his feeding tube, though it seemed unnecessary. He hadn't been in any visible distress, at least not physically. His body was stiff from the stroke, but his face remained calm, untouched by pain. I stayed a moment longer, watching him. The call light didn't go off again. But something still gnawed at me. I didn't talk about it again that night, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. The rest of the shift went by without incident, but when the sun started to rise, I felt the weight of the night lift off my shoulders. I left the hospital feeling exhausted, but somehow relieved. But as I drove home, the voice kept replaying in my head, "He's really hurting." It wasn't until the next day, when I came back in for my shift, that I learned the rest of the story. The nurse who had been with me that night pulled me aside when I got to the unit. "You remember that guy in room 8? She asked, her voice low. I nodded. "He passed away around 4 a.m., she said, "not long after you gave him the pain meds. His vitals were stable before, but we weren't expecting it." My heart dropped into my stomach. I wasn't sure how to respond. The timing, the voice, it all felt so strange, so wrong. I'd been on enough shifts to know that sometimes people pass away unexpectedly, especially those in critical care. But I couldn't shake the thought that somehow something had happened that night that we couldn't explain. The call light going off in the middle of the night, the desperate plea from a voice I couldn't place. It felt like a message. But from who and why? That night haunted me. It wasn't just the strange call light or the voice that stuck with me. It was the fact that no one was there in the room, but someone had known he was in pain. Someone had called out to make sure he wasn't suffering. I never figured it out. Thanks for watching. Don't leave before leaving a like to this video. Also hit the subscribe button to support my work. And as always, have a horrific nightmare, my dear.